Late last month, the pipeline sprung a leak near Little Rock, Arkansas, in the town of Mayflower, spilling between 80,000 and 420,000 gallons of oil. If you haven't heard much about it, that may be because ExxonMobil, which operates the pipeline that ruptured, has limited access to the site. Joining me now are Michael Hiblin, news director of the Arkansas Public Radio station KUAR. He's been covering the spill, and Anthony Swift, National Resources Defense Council lawyer. Welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks.
Michael, how did the residents of Mayflower describe the spill?
Described as a river of oil flowing down the street. Apparently there was a pop that occurred almost 3 weeks ago, and residents said they went outside. There was oil gushing up from the ground, and it was flowing down the street of this upscale residential neighborhood.
And going into people's lawns and their basements?
Indeed, there were a couple of paths that the oil made. One was going behind several homes through backyards. The other was going down the street. And within a matter of minutes, it had flowed into drainage ditches. This was a well-laid-out community, and it was designed to control rainwater, but that sent the oil straight into drainage ditches, and there was initially a frantic effort to stop it from reaching Lake Conway, which is a recreational lake and a large area. The big effort was to stop it from reaching there, and for the most part, they succeeded in that.
I mentioned that there's been a wide range of estimates, 80,000 to 420,000 gallons of oil. Has it tightened up a bit since?
Well, what they're saying is about 5,000 barrels worth of this tar sands crude.
How much is that in gallons?
That comes out to, I believe, the figure I've been going with has been about 210,000 gallons.
Mm-hmm. And the gas, Anthony, the gas in the pipeline was 2 inches wide, 22 feet long. Do we have any idea why something would why it would be so big?
We still don't know exactly what caused the rupture, but certainly these pipelines operate at enormous pressures, hundreds of pounds per square inch, sometimes over 1,000 pounds per square inch. And, you know, that gas is consistent with what we saw in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and that spill was due to stress corrosion cracking and external corrosion, two things that have been associated with tar sands pipelines.
So do these sorts of breaks occur often?
Unfortunately, there's much to indicate yes. You know, the only place in the U.S. where we've seen crudes that have any similarity to tar sands moved consistently is a small series of pipelines in Southern California. And those pipelines have failed due to external corrosion between 8 and 23 times as often as the state's conventional pipelines. And certainly we've seen an increasing number of spills on pipelines moving tar sands from Canada.
At one point, ExxonMobil characterized the spill as being small. Well, what did we say, 5,000 barrels, over 200,000 gallons? That doesn't sound small to me. Is it? Would this be considered small?
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency certainly doesn't consider this a small leak, and it's far above what they considered a small, you know, a large leak to be. And certainly, if that's small, who would want to see a large leak?
Well, Michael, about 22 residents of Mayflower were evacuated. Have any of them been able to return to their homes?
Officials about a week ago gave the green light for people who lived furthest from where the spill occurred. But at this point, none have returned home. At this point, they're waiting for the cleanup to wrap up. You still have a lot of heavy equipment in this neighborhood. And residents, many of whom I've spoken with, have just expressed concern, saying that they're not ready to go back. A lot of these people had children and concerned about the long-term health risks that this could have. You've also got three lawsuits now have been filed by homeowners. Exxon is also making offers to buy the homes, buy the properties from people who do want to sell, who don't want to go back to this neighborhood.
What kind of impact has there been on local wildlife?
You've had quite a few birds, some animals, turtles that have gotten oil on them, and there's been a local effort to take these animals and clean them off. There's a special facility that's been set up where they're taking these animals that have been affected. And they're working just to try to minimize the impact. I mentioned that the oil got near a lake. There's a cove which flows into Lake Conway.
Is that the local wetlands?
It is not. This is actually dry. And there's some dispute about whether or not oil is in wetlands. And it also depends on where you technically consider this lake to begin. The Attorney General of Arkansas, who has been one of the few local officials who's been critical of how ExxonMobil has handled this, he argues that the oil has reached this lake, Lake Conway.
How would it have gotten there?
Well, it flowed the way the drainage system is designed. It's actually set up so that when rainwater comes in, it goes through the drainage ditches and actually flows right into the lake. So in this case, it's just unfortunate that this was oil and that it followed the path that it's designed to follow.
Anthony, what kind of oil runs through this pipeline? Is it the same as tar sands oil?
That's right. The specific type of crude that was moved is something called Wabasca Heavy Diluted Bitumen, and it's something that's considered by Canadian officials and Canadian producers as a bitumen, something produced in the tar sands of Alberta and needs dilution, or basically mixture with natural gas liquids to make it possible to move it in a pipe.
And, do the dilutants create a different kind of pollution than the oil on its own might have?
Well, in many ways, tar sands diluted bitumen is the worst of both worlds because, the dilutants are very volatile. They boil at low temperatures and create a more significant air pollution impact. They contain things like benzene and toluene, which are very toxic to humans. And once they gas off, you're left with this heavy bitumen that if it reaches a water body, it sinks into the water body. And it's very difficult to determine where it's gone and to clean it once you've identified where it is.
Well, I gather that they're putting the equivalent of paper towels onto Lake Conway. But if the oil is sinking to the bottom, would that have much of an impact?
No, and that's one of the things we ran into. There was a similar tar sand spill in Kalamazoo, Michigan, 3 years ago. It was a spill that occurred about 2 miles from the Kalamazoo River, and by the end of it, 38 miles of the Kalamazoo River was contaminated with submerged tar sands and a large part of a nearby lake. One of the difficulties is conventional spill methods, as you note with the paper towels, are fairly rudimentary and tend to rely on oil floating above the water surface. There aren't methods that effectively contain and clean tar sands bitumen that sinks below the water.
So is the oil that we're talking about here similar to the oil that would run through the proposed Keystone XL pipeline?
It certainly is. I mean, Pegasus Pipeline is a pipeline of about 96,000 barrels a day capacity. Keystone XL would move nearly 10 times as much tar sands, and it would be very similar types of crude, some even heavier.
I'm talking with Anthony Swift, a lawyer with the National Resources Defense Council, and with Michael Hiblin, news director of the Arkansas Public Radio Station, KUAR, about the big oil spill or small oil spill, depending on who's telling the story, that occurred in Mayflower, Arkansas, just miles away from Little Rock. Michael, what happened when you tried to gain access to the spill site?
Well, a key problem came a couple of days into it when our Attorney General Dustin McDaniel here in Arkansas, he launched an investigation, and he went out to the site within a couple of days. This happened on a Friday, and by Monday, he launched an investigation, and then he and a team of investigators went out there to the site. I had gotten permission to go along to follow the Attorney General, at least from his staff. So I and a couple of other reporters went along, and when we got there, one of the local people overseeing this, a county administrator, told us the ground rules pretty much, that liability-wise we were on our own, also that we could only watch from a distance. We couldn't follow the Attorney General everywhere he went, but pointed to a designated area, and we were all fine with that, figured we'd watch him and then talk to him afterward. And then about 90 seconds after we were first told this, suddenly, the sheriff's deputies who are securing the scene, the neighborhood where this happened, began yelling that the media has to get out. ExxonMobil does not want you here. And whenever a few of us began asking, well, who made this decision? Who can we talk to with the oil company about this? The sheriff's deputies became agitated and at that point said, you have 10 seconds to leave or you will be arrested. And at that point, we knew we had to talk to the Attorney General, so at that point we left the area. And it wasn't until 9 days after the spill that the media was actually allowed into the area to see the spot where the breach occurred, where the oil flowed, and to actually get a firsthand look at this. You also had ExxonMobil. Well, it was actually the FAA issued a no-fly order over the oil spill because we had several TV stations that had flown helicopters overhead, and the FAA ordered no one to fly over it.
What reason did they give?
They said that it wasn't safe and that it was disruptive for people there on the ground. That order was lifted 2 days later, but clearly there have been issues in terms of access to the neighborhood. And yes, it is an emergency scene, and you do have heavy equipment there, and you have all the workers wearing hazmat suits and hard hats. But it was still a concern, the lack of media access to the site.
Anthony, it sounds to me like the public servants are actually working for ExxonMobil. Is that typical in a situation like this?
Well, it's hard to generalize, but certainly one thing we have found is, you know, when it comes to pipeline safety regulators and other aspects, these companies themselves tend to run the board in a large way. One of the things that the National Transportation Safety Board said about, say, the Kalamazoo spill in Michigan was that in many cases, pipeline regulators kind of delegated their authority to the pipeline companies themselves. And when it comes to spill response, certainly it's an area where, you know, companies are given a very wide latitude over what they can do at the response sites and what sort of methods they can use.
I've heard, Michael, that reporters were barred from some of the public hearings on the spill. Is that true?
There were, in particular, there was one at least that I know of between ExxonMobil and residents of the neighborhood where, yes, reporters were told they could not go into that. There was another one that I sent one of my reporters to, and he was able to get into. A lot of it depends on the persistence, and a lot of especially local reporters who have never covered a spill or don't may not know their rights, may not always put up enough of a fight. And then to a degree, you have to argue your way into it. In the case of the one hearing that we did not cover, I was told that media was told that you can't go in. This is only between Exxon and the residents. But the argument was made, well, this was being conducted in a public school. And so there are efforts to control the media clearly here, but in to a degree about who is actually running the show on the ground. To a good degree, ExxonMobil is, because they are actually running the cleanup, and the local officials have said as long as we feel like ExxonMobil is doing a good job and doing what they should be doing here with the cleanup, they're working together. But it's basically control is being done by four entities: Exxon, the county, the state officials, and federal officials.
Well, EPA, wouldn't EPA feel more accountable to the general public?
They are, but and they're here monitoring the situation and watching it, and all four entities must approve every step that's being taken in the cleanup. But to a good degree, as long as ExxonMobil is doing what the officials feel is appropriate, then they're deferring some power to ExxonMobil.
Anthony, do you think this is the reason this story hasn't been bigger in the press, because they have restricted the media coverage?
Well, certainly. I think that one of the big problems in these spills is the lack of public transparency. And in some ways, one of the reasons it has made it to the press at all is because it happened in a residential community and it occurred where people were and where photos could be taken before Exxon could clamp down on the site.
So I'm assuming, Michael, that a lot of people took pictures of the spill using their cell phones.
Exactly. You had real dramatic footage of people. Once this happened, people started clearing out of the neighborhood, but you had them taking pictures of what, as I described it, a river of oil flowing down the street, and you had it pulling in yards, and it was just very dramatic footage, and that's part of what did get attention on this.
Now, Anthony, the Pegasus pipeline is 65 years old. Is that about the age of much of the pipeline infrastructure across the country?
Well, certainly most of, I mean, the average age of pipelines in the United States is, I think, over 50 years old. So we do have an issue with our aging pipeline infrastructure. And to some extent, much of that is being recruited to move tar sands now. But
it wasn't originally designed to move tar sands?
That's exactly right. In fact, in 2011, the head federal pipeline regulator told Congress that, you know, pipeline regulations weren't designed with tar sands diluted bitumen in mind, and that she couldn't assure the safety or the sufficiency of regulations for that kind of crude transport. And the other side of this, and perhaps most unfortunate, is, you know, we still don't have regulations that are designed for tar sands pipelines, and pipelines like Keystone XL are designed in accordance with really conventional pipeline regulations in mind.
Is corrosion a big concern for pipelines that carry tar sands oil?
Certainly. You've got corrosion is a big issue, and it only increases in severity as time goes on. But we've already seen problems on TransCanada's first Keystone pipeline. That's a pipeline, smaller pipeline, that goes from Canada to the Midwest. In its first year, it spilled 35 times in Canada and the United States, including a 21,000-gallon spill.
So the technology hasn't improved over the last 50 or 60 years?
Well, what tends to happen is, you know, improvements of technology allow pipeline operators to push the envelope based on the conditions that they operate their pipeline. So while the steel might be a little bit better, the pressures that, you know, Keystone XL and Keystone 1 are operated under are higher than the ones that the Pegasus pipeline is operated under. So so you're really seeing the same level of safety because, you know, better materials just allow operators to push the envelope.
Well, Michael, a few years ago, this pipeline was adapted to increase its capacity by 50%. It could now carry more than 90,000 barrels a day. Does that mean that the whole pipeline has been updated as part of this expanding of capacity?
I don't know so much if it has been updated. There are couple of issues, though. One is that officials have speculated part of the problem may be the welding techniques that are long since outdated that were used with this pipeline. Also, another factor is that I believe it was about 7 or 8 years ago, the direction of the flow of oil was reversed in this pipeline. And that apparently puts a lot of pressure on it, and there's some speculation that that could have been the beginning of when things went wrong with this pipeline.
Well, this pipeline runs 858 miles from Illinois to Texas. It would take an awful lot of updating to fix the whole thing. Anthony, does this spill have implications for the debate surrounding Keystone XL? Do you think it's the reason that ExxonMobil is saying that the oil in the Pegasus pipeline isn't tar sands oil?
It certainly is. I think every time there's a tar sands spill and we learn more about it, the industry tries to, you know, more narrowly define what tar sands oil is. But what has happened is, you know, many Americans who were told that Keystone XL is a pipeline to move, you know, Canadian oil into the United States are now learning about the fact, you know, the risks of tar sands crude and pipelines, and they're also learning about the Keystone XL project. They're learning that what will be moving in Keystone XL is not only more dangerous to the communities it crosses, but that it's more carbon intensive, that it's destined for Gulf Coast refineries that will be exporting it to international markets. I think that it's really opened the door to have a more thorough debate about the project on its merits.
Now, Michael, we don't have much more time, but how have local politicians responded to the spill? You said that Attorney General Dustin McDaniel has gotten involved and he's been critical, but have other politicians also been critical, or do they see this as just the price of doing business?
That's essentially been the approach, that we have a congressman here, a Republican named Tim Griffin, who had served in the Bush White House as an aide to Karl Rove. He has been a key advocate calling for approval of the Keystone Pipeline. And since the Pegasus rupture here, he's been making the argument that this is still the safest way to transport any kind of oil, safer than rail, safer than trucks. And he continues to call for the Keystone Pipeline to go forward. But one key change is that we have Central Arkansas Water. They control a lake that provides the drinking water for this area, and the Pegasus Pipeline runs underneath this lake. Central Arkansas Water is now calling for ExxonMobil to move the Keystone, the Pegasus Pipeline away from it, to relocate it, and the congressman here is backing those calls.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you both so much, Michael Hiblin, news director of the Arkansas Public Radio Station KURAR, and Anthony Swift, a lawyer with the National Resources Defense Council.